You're listening to the Young Opportunist Podcast.
So, hey guys, welcome back to another episode. I'm Ben Gregg, and as always, I'm accompanied by my best mate, Reese Chin. And we are so excited for today's discussion with Ryan. Honestly, it's been a long time in the making, and we want to say another huge thank you, Ryan, for joining us today. Yeah, how have you been?
Good. As we were just sort of talking about, it's been it's crazy times for everyone the last year and a half. Everything's been unprecedented. So I'm glad the worst of it's over for everyone. And all in all, mate, I'm really well. And it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So originally, we were going to give the audience a bit of a rundown on your life and career. But honestly, man, you've got a bit of a crazy journey. So I think we're probably all better off if you sort of describe that for us. So if you could just give us a quick rundown on sort of your journey and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a hard one to break down, but I mean, I was originally born in the UK, and then mum and dad immigrated with ourselves as a family to Australia when I was about sort of 10, 11 years of age. And my aspirations growing up were to be a footballer, play for Liverpool. You know, when you're born in the UK, you're sort of, you're given a team and you grow up as a young lad wanting to play for that team. That's it really, you know. Doctors, scientists, none of that comes into the equation. It's basically, I want to be a footballer.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, anyway, that was sort of my dream growing up as a kid. And then I played right the way up until we left to come to Australia. Anyway, we moved to Australia when I was about sort of 10, 11 years of age. And when I got here, I really, really struggled. I was an English kid. I had an English accent. I was covered in spots. And I couldn't understand why my mum and dad had taken me away from sort of everything that I knew. And they were always saying to me, you know, look, we're going as a family. There's more opportunity in Australia for us as a family. And look, I look back now and they were 100% correct. Yeah. But at 11, 12, 13 years of age, that's really hard to comprehend. And I think what made it, when I look back, even more difficult for me is when we got to Australia originally, my sister took to it like a duck to water. She was very academically easy to find her way into, you know, a bit of a flow at school. She was socially doing a little bit better than me. So I just felt really, really lost. I remember that time in my life being really, really odd. And then I found school to be academically easy, but socially very hard.
Mm.
And so for that reason, I didn't enjoy going to school for any reason. There was no challenge there. And socially, it just wasn't working out for me at all. Like, I wouldn't say I was extremely bullied, but I wasn't welcomed into the playground every day, shall we say. So I felt like a bit of a loner. I felt like a bit of a misfit. I decided to get a job. I got a job at McDonald's in Charnwood in Canberra. And I'll never forget, I walked into McDonald's and I was lucky because I had a guy who was my boss called Luca. And I remember I turned up on the day. And basically he said, here's your uniform, here's your hat. He said, don't ever be late and make sure your uniform's ironed and tidy every time you come to work. If either of those two things don't take place, I'm going to send you home. And I was just like, okay, it was different to a teacher, like at school bossing you around. It was almost like, I'm going to leave it up to you, but that's the standard.
It's like now it's the responsibility is on you.
Yeah. And I remember my brain just went, this is a bit of me. And then I walked into the kitchen and the pace. And I know it sounds crazy because it's McDonald's, but mate,
pumping out those pancakes.
Hotcakes, cheeseburgers. Everyone's ordering, you know, different things without certain things, and like, it's a really busy place. And there's a real strong team culture. You've got to be efficient. You've got to be able to communicate. You know, you're paid at the end of the week. You were judged on your ability to get a job done. Yeah. And I just straight away, that made way more sense to me than school. And that's when things turned a little bit for me. So I used to basically get on the school bus. I told McDonald's that I was able to work there full time and I didn't go to school anymore as soon as I turned, I think, 16.
Yeah.
I told my parents that I was going to school and I would get on the bus. I would get off. I would go to McDonald's. I'd work all day. I'd come home. I'd get changed. So it looked like I'd come home from school and then go work another shift.
That's the hustle.
And then that lasted for about 3 weeks. And then I sort of got found out. And
as you do.
That's when I had to have the conversation with mum and dad, which basically was along the lines of, look, school, I don't think is for me. And mum and dad were sort of really supportive of that. I look back now and I just think, you know, I'm really thankful that they were the way they were about it. Mum just said to me, well, look, if you're going to leave school, you need to make sure you've got a full-time job. You need to get an apprenticeship. and you need to make sure that you're on some sort of a career path. And that's when I was like, okay. And then that's when ambition kicked in. I remember working at McDonald's. I worked my way up into a crew trainer role, then into a manager role. And there was this other guy that I used to work with, and he was about 40 years of age. And I just kept saying to myself, if I don't leave here, that's me for the next sort of 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking, like, he's a lovely guy. Like, I'm not putting him down. He was a really lovely guy, and, you know, he was good at what he did. But I just thought, I want more than that. And that's when I sort of sat back and went, okay, well, I work in a kitchen. So if I'm going to work in a kitchen, why don't I just work in a real kitchen? Why don't I just become a chef?
Mm.
That is my apprenticeship. I can just become an apprentice chef. So I basically applied for a few jobs, and then I managed to get myself a job at a restaurant called Parlor Wine Room, which is in the city. And again, I got really lucky because of who I worked with. So there was a real standard within the kitchen. And like people say to me now, where did you go to school? I say a kitchen. Because it was work ethic, discipline, structure, attention to detail, cut the shit, get the job done. You know,
intense, I reckon.
Yeah, listen, it's a very intense environment. I was working 15-hour days, 7 days a week. You're coming in the morning, you work till about 4 p.m., you go away for 2 hours, you have a split shift, you come back, you're there till about 11 p.m., then you've got to clean everything, then you've got to somehow have dinner, somehow go to the gym, then you've got to get up and go again. So it was a really intense environment. And the other thing about it as well is I was now surrounded by grown men. So I'm in a room of grown men. You know, there's heavy metal coming out of the radio. People are smoking. They're drinking during the day. And it was just like a completely different world to what I'd come out of.
Hmm.
And I worked for a guy at the time who was, like I said, incredibly intense. He used to come over to me at the end of my shift, and he would pick up my bin and he would empty my bin on the floor. And he would work through everything on the floor, and he'd put it up on the bench, and he'd say, okay, you could have cut this onion closer to the end. You could have cut these herbs finer. You could have done this more with the tomato. You could have got more flesh out of this bit of fruit. You add all that up every day. By the end of the week, you've cost me $300.
Yeah.
Do you want me to take that out of your wages? And I was like, well, no, I don't. And he said, well, then become better with your knife skills. So this guy just had a real attention to detail, and that stuck with me like until today in my work. So I look back on that time and I just think it was really, really pivotal for me when I've transferred into business. And then I decided, okay, if I'm going to be a chef, where's the biggest challenge for myself? What's the top of the culinary sort of world at the moment? It was London. I had dual nationality because I was born in the UK. So at 17 and a half years of age, I decided to move to London on my own. And again, mum and dad said, listen, Ryan, we'll support you. You know, if that's what you want to do, away you go. So I landed in London. I went on Gumtree. I found a room in a share house in Plaistow. I had a uniform. I had no job lined up. I knew I'd get one when I got there. And I walked into the back of a restaurant called The Lux on Liverpool Street. And I walked into the back of the restaurant, and I walked in and I just said, look, I'm prepared to work for free for 2 weeks. And if in 2 weeks' time I'm still here, I'd like a job. And he just said, get in the sink. I was washing dishes, peeling potatoes, cutting onions. And I just made sure I did all of that quickly and to a standard, freed up time, permission to speak, chef. Yep. Okay. I've got 10 minutes here. Is there anything you need done? Okay. Get the quail out, do the prawns. Da-da-da-da-da. And then after a week and a half, they sat me down and said, here's a contract. So then I ended up staying there for about 2 years in total. And that's when I finished my apprenticeship as a chef. But I think a lot of people think chefs just cook. They don't. There's a massive business element to a chef. And this is where the sales and the business side sort of fell on my lap. The guy that I was working for at the time, while I was hosing the floors, while I was packing everything down, he would always sit in the office and I could hear him on a phone negotiating with suppliers for vegetables and fruit and, you know, supplies. And that then affected our margin and our profit and all these sorts of things. And I heard him on the phone and I thought, he's terrible on the phone. Like, he sounds like he's really struggling, you know, and it can't be that hard. I mean, he's negotiating on potatoes and tomatoes. So I thought, I'm going to ask him if I can have a go.
Yeah.
Almost like as a laugh, you know. So I went in and I said to him, listen, mate, what are you doing in here of an evening? And he goes, oh, mate, listen, like, he goes, I hate it. It's the worst part of my job, you know, and he's showing me all the paperwork and stuff. And I said, well, listen, let me have a go. I said, I bet you any money I can get them cheaper than what you are, right? Yeah. So the first deal I ever did was some fruit and vegetables. And then he was like, okay, you're pretty good at that. He goes, you can keep doing it. So that then got me on a phone. That then got me negotiating. That then got me dealing with suppliers. That then got me looking at the numbers. So then it's all of a sudden, I remember when I was cooking, it was still food, but I was looking at it different. I was almost like, I know that dish has just made us $7. Bang. Yeah. I could see the mechanics of how the business within a kitchen worked. And then I decided that I didn't want to be a chef for the rest of my life. I sort of started to realize that wasn't what I wanted to do forever. You know, I was dealing with people every day who were like 45, 50. They never got to see their wives. They never got to see their kids. They were, you know, the drinking habits and things like this. It was a real...
Yeah, it's a very tough life. Like, I worked in hospitality in Manuka and they're doing huge hours. And like, they're normally, each chef that I've met has a habit of, yeah, heavily smoking, or they love the grog. Because, you know, they're on their feet all day. And like you said, you only get a little break. And to fit all of that leisure time into that, it's like there's no work-life balance at all.
There's not. And the other thing that people forget about a chef is it's a very unrewarding job. Because you're spending 10 hours in a room to serve 100 people. Now, how many out of those 100 come to the pass and say, thank you, that was a lovely meal, I really appreciate it?
Yeah.
Not many.
There was always the waiters that get all the rewards.
I just felt unappreciated. I just felt like it wasn't the industry I wanted to be in long term. I felt like it was unsustainable. But I learned so much, and it was an amazing apprenticeship in many ways in terms of life and work. And a lot of what I learned, like I said, in a kitchen, I've kept with me. And then I decided to come back to Australia, and my dad's been in cars his whole life. So when I got back, I said to my dad, look, I want to get into sales. I want to get into business. What do you suggest? And he said, well, listen, cars is, you know, you hit a ceiling pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, you'll end up with a couple of dealerships and that's pretty much it. You know, unless you go and invent a new car brand, it's pretty limited. And he said, if you're going to sell something, you should look at selling houses. He said, but before you do, you should go and get some sort of base experience in sales. And this is when it all just like took off. It just really started to happen really quickly from here. So just to summarize, I'm now 21 years of age. I've got no business experience other than the basic stuff I'm doing in the kitchen. I've left school. I've got no qualifications other than as a chef. But I've done a bit of traveling. I know a little bit about myself and, you know, I'm full of energy, really. So I moved to the Gold Coast because when I came back from London, I didn't want to stay in Canberra. All my friends were doing the same sort of thing. And I just wanted to have a new chapter. And England's incredibly cold. So I thought, where's the sun? And that was literally my decision-making process. I want to get out of Canberra and I want to go somewhere warm and I'll just figure the rest out. I'll get a job. So I moved to the Gold Coast and I got a job at Harvey Norman in Bundle, which is, and I didn't know this when I applied for the job, it's the biggest retail store in Queensland.
Yeah, right.
And it's owned by a gentleman named Jerry Harvey, as you may know.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So I get a job there and I started with two other guys and I walked into this shop and I had a horrible uniform, like a little spotty tie and a short sleeve like blue shirt. I looked like a mall cop.
On the little unicycle things, that
the scooters. Yeah. And I just remember walking in thinking, like, I look like an absolute dick. You know, like, it doesn't fit me, it's uncomfortable. Like, and I was actually I wasn't very confident as a person at this time. Like, I was like, fucking, like, trying to figure myself out a lot. And I think. I remember I started and there was two other people. And basically the way the store was set up is you had TVs, you had white goods, which is like fridges, freezers. You had kitchens, which is like ovens, cooktops, range hoods. And then you had appliances, which is like toasters, kettles, and stick blenders, right? Yeah. And I was just like, please don't put me in toasters. You know, like in my head, I'm thinking, I really don't want to end up in the toaster section dressed like this. And then he goes to the other guy, he goes, okay, mate, you've been put into white goods. And he was like older than me. So I thought, they've put the experienced guy there. They said to the lady, we're going to put you into TVs. And Ryan, we're putting you in toasters.
Where's the best part? Like, where does people look at that and be like, yeah, that's where I want to be? Like, kitchens, is it the white man. Kitchens? Yeah, right.
Yeah. But I'll tell you how it all went down in a sec because I didn't last in toasters very long. So basically, I got put into the toaster section and I was like, okay. And they were like, someone's going to come in tomorrow and give you your training. And I'm like, training?
How to use the toaster? Like,
I'm going to ask someone which color toaster they want. And do you want 4 slice or 2 slice? Like, there's not much to it.
That's so good.
So I'm stood there. It's my first week. I'm selling stuff. And already I'm starting to noticing. So the guy in kitchens was like leaning up against the oven and there's customers walking around. He hasn't even like gone over and spoken to them. And like the rule is you can't leave your section. Right. I'm looking over at TVs. She's doing a bit better than this guy, but she's doing a few things that I would probably do better in my opinion at this time. I think she's just sort of like floating around. She's not really greeting people. I'm like, she's missing opportunity. And I was working out that in between customers, I was stood around for like an hour doing nothing. So every like half an hour, someone would walk in and then there was an hour where I was doing nothing. So I started to get really frustrated. And I'll never forget it. There was a guy and he was always saying, if you've got time to lean, you've got time to clean. And I was like, mate, you can see your face in the carpet. I've cleaned everything. There's nothing left that I could possibly clean in this section. We're not making toast. Like, there's no crumbs in here. So I started to use my initiative and I just started going into other areas. So someone would come in and say, I want a toaster. I'm like, do you need a new oven? Do you need a new fridge? Yeah. How's your telly? And I just started to like cross sell. And my logic was I can't get in trouble for making the money. Yeah. I can't get sacked for making the business money. So basically things started to escalate in the sense that I started selling ovens. I started selling range hoods. And because I'd worked in kitchens, I could relate to the product. I could say like back in London when I was working as a chef, we had a pyrolytic oven, which was self-clean. I'd strongly recommend it. It saves you a lot of time. And then I could give a demonstration. It was relatable. And that's where I started to learn that as long as you know your product, whether you're selling a toaster or a $10 million house, if you know your product, you're personable, you know how to communicate, and you're honest and genuine, you can sell anything, anything.
Yeah, that's so true.
And I think it's that genuine piece is like one of the biggest as well.
Yeah, and that is backed up when you know what you're talking about. So if you know your product inside and out and you're genuine, you can't lose because they go, not only does he know what he's talking about and everything he said is true, he's not tried to do anything left of center here the whole time I've dealt with him.
Yeah.
And that starts to really build a relationship with someone that you can't break, you know? So I started selling all over the shop and then my sales were going up and up and up. And then even more so, I was like, okay, I want to start thinking outside the box here. I know every product inside and out across the store. What's something that no one else is doing? I've got half an hour in between customers where I'm doing nothing. So I went to my boss and I said, I want a business phone. And he's like, well, what for? And I just said, just trust me. I just want a business phone. And then what I did is I rang in between customers, local businesses. So I rang hairdressers. I rang mechanics. I rang anywhere that I knew would have a tea room in the back of the business. And I'd say, my name's Ryan Fisher from Harvey Norman. I want to do you an incredible deal on a toaster, kettle, and microwave and bar fridge bundle. I'm prepared to take your old stuff and donate it. Free delivery. Get brand new stuff into the business. Special deal. Are you interested? Some people would say, you know, piss off. Some people would say, oh, can you call me back next week? I'm not the owner. But then every now and then someone would say, yeah, mate, that sounds great. Shoot me across an invoice. Some you'd never hear from again, even though you've sent the invoice, but about 3 or 4 a week were buying it. So then my sales were just like, you know, starting to become very visibly higher than anyone else in the business. And then one day my phone rang on my hip. And my boss, Steve, said, I need you to come upstairs and we need to have a chat. So I went upstairs and I thought, shit, have I done something wrong or, you know. And he sat me down and he said, look, I've been looking at your numbers. I've been hearing certain things. Really, really impressed. I like the initiative that you've shown. We're going to take you out of retail and we're going to put you into our commercial division. So basically what I was now doing is selling 1,000 ovens, 1,000 cooktops, 1,000 fridges and 1,000 toasters to developers for their developments. And basically, I had to go and find developments from the ground level that hadn't been built yet and negotiate the contracts for the appliances to go in as they build them.
Oh, yeah.
So I had to sit down and work out, like, land developments, go down with coffees, meet the foreman, work out who the architect was. The architect would put me onto the builder. The builder told me to go fuck myself. Sorry about my friend. And it was just like this constant battle to end up speaking to the person I needed to get to.
Yeah.
And then a guy turned to me one day and he said, you should get into real estate. And he was a developer, like a big developer in Queensland. He said, mate, you should get into real estate. And I thought, my dad said that. And maybe I've done that little bit of time that I needed to do, because if people in the industry are telling me you should look at it, maybe I'm ready.
Yeah, you're doing something right.
Yeah. So that's when I made the decision, okay, I'm going to get into real estate. I'm going to get into property. Now, at this time, I decided that Queensland and the Gold Coast wasn't really for me long term. Gold Coast is pretty party party. I felt like I wanted to get into a city like a Sydney or a Melbourne. And do property, because I just feel like there's more opportunity in that industry, in that sector. And I'm so glad I did, because it was the right move. And I looked at Sydney, and having been in London, I thought maybe Sydney was a bit too big. Melbourne had a bit more of a sport feel to it. Because everything I'm saying to you, like in amongst all of this, I'm obsessed with English football.
Yeah.
So like whilst I'm telling you everything, I'm obsessed with English football from the start right the way to the end of this story. And I will be till the day I pass away.
Up at like 4 a.m. watching Premier League games.
Yeah. And studying like the market, the business side of it, which we'll get to. So basically I moved to Melbourne. I make a list of the top three real estate agents in the area. And I went and had interviews with them, and I got hired by a company. So I moved my whole life down to Melbourne, got myself a couple of suits, and basically went in on the first day. And I look back now, I was probably a little bit eager, but I tried to replicate some of the stuff I was doing in the kitchen. So I said to the boss, I said, can I have the alarm code for the office? And he goes, well, what for? I said, because I'll be the first in and the last out.
Yeah.
And in my head, I'm thinking, like, that should impress this guy. I wasn't doing it for him. I was doing it for me, but I just felt like it's a good way to start off. My logic was at 6 o'clock in the evening till about 10 o'clock at night, that's when everyone's at home. So that's when I'm going to be on the phone ringing people, which was the same logic I applied at Harvey Norman, and that worked. So I was like, okay, I'm going to apply the work rate I had from the kitchen. I'm going to use some of the business skills that I used while I was at Harvey Norman. I'm going to hit the ground running in this role. And after a week, they sacked me. They fired me. So he sat me down and he just said, look, I don't think real estate's for you. You know, you're calling people mate. You're calling people at 8 o'clock at night. You know, you're disrupting my relationships in the market. And listen, he was very old school. He was like 60. And what made me disagree with him is that I had been speaking to the people on the phone and I knew how the conversations were going, and they were going well.
Yeah.
So my communication with the market, I could tell just by the calls I was having. People were like, mate, we've got this property here. You know, it's great of you to call. Isn't it great to hear from an agent at this time of night? I hate it when they ring me at 7 a.m, like I'm getting the kids ready. And I could just tell that the market wasn't getting angry at me. Do you know what I mean?
But this boss was, kind of thing.
But he was like, that's not how we do it. These are not the rules. This is not the way the industry works. So I thought, it's the wrong fit, basically. Yeah.
Such a classic, like old school, doesn't like change.
And what it is, because it's the way it is and not changing it up.
Exactly.
Correct. Which is fine. You know, it's worked for so long and he's got a life out of it. And, you know, I wish him all the best, but you know, you've also got to, you know, I think you've got to be adaptable. I think that's important. So got sacked. I was very lost. It was a real low point for me. I thought, you know, I've just moved my whole life here. Have I made a massive mistake? Is he right? Cause you start to think maybe he's right. And then I came across an individual who was about to launch a business, a bit of a different brand. It wasn't suit and tie. It was a bit more, you know, loafers and chinos sort of thing, a bit more relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to go into the higher end of the market. And he just sort of said to me, listen, you've got something about you. This is what I'm looking to do. If you want to come and start with me, then let's do it. So on the 1st of February, 2017, I started with a company in Melbourne, White Fox. And to put it into perspective, so I'd never sold a house before. I was a new agent in a new market for a new business. And basically what I did is I decided that I was just going to give this 100% attention. Now, money was really scarce at the time, so I had to get a night job cleaning, which was really tough. And the reason I had to get a night job is because I couldn't let anyone in the market see me at a restaurant or at a bar working.
Mm.
Not that I was ashamed, but it just doesn't make sense. If I go and give someone an appraisal on their house at 5 o'clock, and then at 8 o'clock they walk into an Italian restaurant and I'm serving them.
Yeah.
It's like something doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So I knew that a cleaning job would be the only job available that I could do between 1 a.m. to sort of 3 a.m., earn enough money to pay rent, and then still be accessible all day to learn my craft in real estate and sort of build up my career. So that's what I did. And then basically for the first 6 months, I was just on the phone. I was contacting people whose properties hadn't sold at auction, and I was just really trying to get that first listing. And then I successfully listed a house for $4 million, wow. And I managed to sell it within only 2 weeks.
Jeez.
That then led to me listing an $8.5 million penthouse, which had been on the market for 6 years with Sotheby's. It actually belonged to Leighton Hewitt, so it was very high profile.
Wow.
I sold that in 45 days. That then led me to listing the person who bought that house's house, which I then sold for around $6 million. And then in my first year and a half in real estate, transacted $170 million worth of residential real estate in the Melbourne market. Spoke at the largest real estate conference in the country, was on Sky News as a real estate presenter, and had an amazing journey in the real estate industry.
Wow.
But that's when a real big life lesson came along, and I was earning really good money. On paper, what society had told me success looks like, I had everything.
Yeah.
And it happened really quick because I was cleaning bathrooms 9 months before. And that's the thing about real estate. If you're good at it, it has the ability to make you a lot of money very quickly, because of how transactional it can be. So I did what every 24-year-old would do with that sort of money coming in. I bought an incredibly nice BMW. I bought an incredibly nice watch. I bought some incredibly nice clothes. I moved into a nicer apartment. I was in a one-bedroom shit box in St Kilda, basically, and I was driving a Toyota Camry with a massive dent in the side for probably the first 6 months of my career. So it was nice to get out of that.
Yeah.
And I look back now and I earned it. I don't regret it. I earned it. It's not like I went and robbed the bank. I earned the money. But very quickly, I started to become quite miserable because, you know, all these things that society was telling me I needed to have, I've got them. And I'm like, well, why aren't I feeling fucking fulfilled? Why aren't I feeling happy? Why aren't I consistently in a really good place every day, you know? And that's when I felt like I needed to just pull the chute and get out of there and go and sort of figure myself out a bit. So I wanted a new challenge. I'd always loved football, like I said. And I'll never forget the day I was driving down a street which I'd sold a lot of property on, and I was in the Beamer, and I was driving past all these houses thinking, like, I sold that. I sold that. And I got to a set of lights, and I was just like, I honestly think I'm the most miserable person in Melbourne right now. Like, I just feel lost, empty, confused. I don't really know why I feel this way. You know, I've worked so hard. This is everything that I've ever dreamt of sort of having. Like, why do I feel so shit, you know?
Even like sort of like, was it pretty lonely? Like, I could imagine you moving to Melbourne initially, like getting your first job. I could imagine that being, a bit lonely. Yeah, you're making some good money. But yeah, how was that sort of aspect of it?
Yeah, listen, I've had quite a close circle my whole life in terms of, I'm not someone who, like, if I was to get married tomorrow, best way to put it, if I was to get married tomorrow, it can be 15 people there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I see people have these weddings with 200 people and I go, I don't even know 200 people. Like, I don't. Yeah. And I don't want to buy 200 people prawn sandwiches.
Oh, definitely not. $100 a head.
I don't want to pay for 200 people to get pissed and then go home. It's not happening. I think so. I think I like my own company. I think I'm very self-reflective. I'm very deep in terms of the way I think. And as I've gotten older and as I've gotten a little bit wiser, like, my favorite thing to do is go for a walk with a podcast. That's my favorite thing to do. Because you're out, your endorphins are good, you're exercising, you're listening to some content that's, you know, informative or educational. Like, you can't go for a podcast and a walk with someone.
No.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it's funny that my favorite thing to actually do is on my own. With that said, you know, when I'm in the company of a friend that I really love and who we've got some commonality, or when I'm in a meeting and I meet someone new that, you know, is in, you know, Bitcoin or in prop tech or in design or in a completely different industry to me, but is incredibly successful. And you sit there and you connect for an hour and you bounce around. I love that sort of stuff. But in terms of socially, do I have, you know, 10, 15, 20 friends that I go out a dinner with, party. Not really. I've never sort of been like that.
Mm.
But yeah, I think lonely is a good word. And I think I was lonely because I didn't know who I was yet personally. Mm. So when you're trying to figure yourself out and the only person you're walking around with every day is you and you don't quite know who you are, it's like, well, where do you go with that? You know? And so I sat down and I went, okay, I love football. I've got a good business skill set. I'm 25. I'm single. I've got enough money behind me to take a risk. I'm young enough to take a risk. I know that I'll make it work because that's what I'm like. Why don't you move to Europe and become a football agent? That's the biggest challenge you can think of. Like, just go for it. What have you got to lose? You got everything to gain. And you just may find something that you're trying to figure out about yourself on that path. So I resigned. I sold the car. I got rid of everything. Yeah. And I remember stood there and I was like, it's me in a bag. It's me in a bag and a laptop. That's what I've got. I've got a bit of money behind me and I've got this massive adventure in front of me. And already I started to feel better because I was like, this stuff's real. This is like the stuff that's real. Yeah. This was all just fucking excess. It was just noise. Yeah. It's like pure and impure.
Yeah, it's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with having a nice car as long as like everything else is okay as well. But if you're like buying a nice car because you think that's going to fix something, you're way off.
Yeah.
Like you're not even close to being like where that car thinks it's going to get you. That's what I learned. So I got on a plane and I remember I didn't have any sort of real plan on what I was going to do other than just work it out. And on the plane, I was like, okay, I've got 24 hours on a flight. I'm going to type up my business plan. So typically a football agent, for those of you listening who don't know, their job is to basically facilitate a broker, a deal between a football player and a club. So if I was to sign one of you two gentlemen now as my client, you're a footballer. My responsibility is to make sure that your contract is properly taken care of and that if the club you're at doesn't want you, I find you a new club and broker that deal. Or if the club you're at wants to keep you, I make sure I negotiate the best deal for you to stay. Okay. On top of that, an agent's job is to look after the commercial assets, the commercial structure, the commercial strategy around the player. So their finances and their business side.
It's like a whole other world you just forget sort of exists.
Yeah, I didn't know that part. Like, I definitely knew about the contracts, but I never knew you even go further and look into that side of it. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, how do I get clients? What I'm an Australian guy landing in England. I don't know fucking anyone. I've got an Australian accent, which means people in football are going to not take me that seriously, even though I'm English.
Mm.
I don't have any contacts. I don't know the first thing about the legalities in a contract. You know, I don't know anything. I'm brand new. But I really didn't want to go and work for another agency because I wanted to find my own feet and I wanted to represent what I believed as right, because there's a lot of football agencies out there that do things incredibly wrong. They're in it for the money. They churn and burn the players. They get the money out of the contract. They don't service the relationship. They don't look after the player. And then a lot of them hit 31, 32, 33. They're left with nothing.
Yeah.
The mental health kicks in. They start drinking. The agent's back at the academy doing it all over again. And, you know, they're left to their own devices. I didn't want to go and align myself with companies who I knew were doing that.
Mm.
So I wanted to stay on my own. So I decided to go in a bit different. And instead of standing at academies and watching players and speaking to parents and, you know, maintaining these fictitious relationships until the player becomes a point of income, I decided I'm good at getting indoors. I'm good at presenting. I know how to communicate. And I'm fucking tenacious. So I'm going to go in at club level. So I went onto each football club website. I made a list of all the internal members of staff, director of football, head of recruitment, CEO, chief exec, put them into an Excel spreadsheet in alphabetical order under each club. And I set up a 3-point communication strategy. So it was letter, call, email, letter, call, email. I landed. And this is where you create your own luck. So for those of you that watch football and know a lot about Liverpool, there was a player at Liverpool called Jamie Carragher. Massive, massive player. Was vice captain with Steven Gerrard at Liverpool. So I set up my little system. I went into a print shop and I said, I need you to print 500 letters. And I was going to sit down and hand sign all these letters and send them out to all the clubs saying, my name's Ryan. I'd love to have a meeting, basically. So anyway, I've gone into this print shop. She said, look, this is going to take 3 or 4 hours. You're going to have to come back. And I said, yeah, that's fine. No probs. So I walked out and I just decided to go for a walk around Liverpool. I just moved there. And I walked into a clothes shop. And Jamie Carragher stood there with his son.
Wow.
No way.
I was like, fucking hell, that's Cara.
Mm.
So I was like, okay, quickly, what are you going to do? So I went over and I said, hey, mate, how are you? And he was like, who the fuck are you? Literally. And I said, my name's Ryan. Sorry to bother you. I said, I don't want a photo or an autograph or anything. I said, I just wondered if I could 5 minutes of your time. And he said, what's it about? And I said, look, I know that you've got a I know that you've got an academy locally. So he's got an academy which basically helps kids off the street play football.
Okay, yeah.
And one of the things that I wanted to do with the business was invest 10% of all profit back into the game.
Yeah, cool.
So I knew he had an academy, and I was actually planning to contact the academy at some point to find out where money could be distributed around grassroots to help. So I said to him, listen, I know you've got an academy in the area. I said, I've just moved over from Australia. I've got a business model that I think could be successful here in football. It's my dream to break into the football market. I'm a massive Red, massive fan, by the way. I said, can I just have 5 minutes to show you what it is I'm doing? And he just bit me off and said, listen, give my mate James a call. He runs my academy. All the best. And he gives me a number and he said, I'll see you later. I'm with my lad. And I said, mate, pleasure to meet you. No problems. Now, you got to look at it, right? You're in the clothes shop with your son and a random Australian guy comes up to you and starts telling you that, you know, he's got some business idea. You're going to go, yeah, okay, mate, you know, fuck off.
Yeah.
He gives me a number. I ring the number, James. James is now one of my best mates. So I ring James and I'm like, hello. And he goes, who's this? And I said, is this James? And he goes, well, you rang me, mate. And I was like, and I said, look, my name's Ryan. Anyway, went into a conversation. We met for coffee. I showed him everything. He said, mate, I'm all for it. I think you're great. Love it. He said, listen, what are you doing Friday? There's an event. Kara's speaking. Come down. So I went down. He basically said to Kara, listen, he's got past the dickhead test. Give him 5 minutes. That led to me having the opportunity to show Jamie the business. And then he actually put me in touch with the director of football at Liverpool. And that's how I got my first meeting.
Wow. That was like so instant. Like you said, were you literally typing your business plan on the plane?
I literally came up with a strategy of how I was going to do it on the plane. And then it's little bits of luck like that, but you create your own luck. Like if I hadn't got on the plane, moved to Liverpool, had the sort of ambition to try and do this, I would never have been in that clothes shop on that day where he was stood to have that interaction. You've got to go out into the universe and tell it what you want. You've got to believe in what you believe. You've got to go about things the right way. You've got to treat people how you want to be treated, but you've got to be tenacious. You've got to show ambition. And one of my favorite quotes in the whole world, which is relevant to this, and this is something that I always use when I'm in a really hard place. If you were walking down the street and you saw someone lying there, not moving, you'd keep walking. But if he was crawling, you'd give him a hand up. And it's the same thing in life. If you come across someone who's got ambition, you will help them and you will connect.
Yeah.
People who are like-minded, people who can see someone's doing their best, people who can see that someone's trying to do things the right way, people who can see that there's someone in front of them who's like, you know what, faults and all, he's doing everything he can to get where he wants to get. People respect that. And I know I've helped people in life who I've come across who are giving me that sort of vibe.
Even you coming on tonight, like that's you helping us out. And you know, we're pretty small at the moment and like right now, but it's in the goodwill of you to come onto the show and, you know, help us out.
Yeah. Well, guys, like, I mean, I think what you're doing is great because you've looked at each other and gone, okay, we're close mates. You know, we love having conversations. We like meeting people out there who are doing things, you know. Let's create a platform and let's do it. You know, there's probably thousands of people who have got the idea to do it who don't.
100%. That's the difference.
A couple of mates sitting there having a chat. You know, we should do this. We should do that. You know, there's a lot of people with ideas. Ideas are great. That's the first part. But then going away and doing it takes something else. So you're right in a way, but I don't think you're small. I think you're a seed that can become anything you want to become. You know, the only thing stopping you is yourselves. That's like anyone. That led to a few meetings. And off the back of that, I started getting into other doors. I met with, you know, some of the top clubs in Europe. Then I ran out of money. I completely just ran out of money. I was nowhere near signing a player. I was nowhere near signing a client. And I remember I had about $4,000 left in my bank. And I thought, you know what, if I'm going to be stuck, I'd rather be stuck somewhere warm. So I went to Portugal. And I just basically paid for a hostel for a month. And you've got to remember, like a year before, I was on stage in front of 5,000 people. I was earning between, you know, however many thousands of dollars a month consistently. I had all these things going on. And here I am a year later, in my head, I've failed. I'm in a hostel in a dorm with 12 other people. I've got four grand to my name. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, like, what the hell is going on? But I knew I was on the right track because I was happier than when I was sat in the BMW a year before.
Jeez.
I felt more fulfilled. I felt like I was making more sense of myself. And I felt like I was making more progress in that dorm room with four grand to my name than when I was sat in a 90 grand car bombing around like I thought I was, you know, Billy Big Bollocks, right? I just completely lost sense of who I was. And then I met someone who became really important and who I still speak to today, Tim. And I'll tell you a quick funny story. So I'm in this hostel. I was down and out, like beyond belief. I was flat as a tack. I had no motivation. I was lost. I was really down on myself. I didn't know what I was going to do. Do I go back to Australia and get into real estate and try and figure life out again? No, I don't. I don't want to get sucked back into that trap. Do I just go to London and get a job doing sales just so I can stay in the UK and then just keep waiting until I get that first football client? You know, what do I do? Like, I'm really lost. And was feeling real sorry for myself. And then this guy walked into the hostel, into the dorm with an ironing board, right? And he walks in with this ironing board. He puts it up against the wall and everyone in the dorm's like, fuck. Like, takes off his backpack, gets a few things out, gets into bed, goes to sleep. And I just thought, you know what? It's none of my fucking business. So I basically just went straight back to sleep and, you know, got up in the morning and he was gone. So I thought, I'll never see that guy ever again. And anyway, went for a walk, did my thing, came home, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, in he comes, bag, ironing board. And mate, like, I mean a big ironing board, yeah?
Not one of those tiny ones that like you can fit in your back. Backpack.
And because it was daytime, I could now see that it was black and it had glitter all over it. And I'm just like, I've got to know what's going on here.
Yeah.
Like, I've got to ask this guy. So I said to him, I said, mate, I hope you don't mind me asking. I said, I'm Ryan. Nice to meet you. And he said, yeah, Tim. I said, yeah. I said, why are you carrying around an ironing board covered in glitter? And he goes, well, how long have you got? And I said, well, mate, I'm not going anywhere. Like, enlighten me. And he said, well, look, I was a CEO of a massive company. He said, and I was worth, you know, millions of pounds and found out my wife cheated on me with my business partner. So I actually assaulted him. So he sued me out of my own business and she took the rest of my money, basically. They're now together. He runs my business, lives in my house. And he's like, I've got hardly any money left. And I was just like, wow, that's heavy, you know? But he had a really good soul about him. He just seemed like a really genuine guy. And I could tell he was really hurt, but he was like, you know, still doing his best. And I was like, okay, but that doesn't explain the ironing board, mate. You know, can we get to the ironing board, you know? And he goes, well, I always wanted to do two things. I wanted to travel and I wanted to do magic. Yeah. And I was like, okay. And then he opened up the ironing board and he pulled out a deck of cards and he said, this is my magic table. Basically, what this guy does is he travels around Europe doing shows out on the street to earn enough money to pay for a hostel and get himself to the next country and travel.
Yeah, that's cool.
And he just said to me, I've had everything. I've had everything in the middle and I've got what I've got now. And he said, I'm happy. He said, I wouldn't change anything. He goes, I was in a bad relationship. You know, he goes, I was lying to myself. I got caught in the corporate cycle.
Mm-hmm. The rat race.
I just sort of thought to myself, like on a different scale, I could really understand what he meant. You know, like I hadn't earned as much as him. I hadn't done some of the things he'd done, but the principle of what he was saying, I was like, I can really get where you're coming from. And he said, what's your story? And I told him my story. And he said, listen, he goes, if your dream is to stand in a football stadium and do a transfer, do not stop until you've done that. He said, it might not be your dream in 10 years, but until you've done it, that's your dream.
Mm.
He said, so do it. He said, whatever it takes. And he said, but my advice would be to go to Australia again, refinance, reassess what you've learned and come back stronger and go again. So with that $4,000, I decided to come back to Australia for 12 months and do that. So I came back to Australia 2 years ago, landed. Everyone's like, haha, you failed. you know. I bought myself a little Mini Cooper. So I'd gone from Beamer around town to little red Mini. And everyone loved that because everyone's like, you know, here he is,
classic,
you know. And it honestly, it didn't affect me because I was like, I gave it everything I had. If that wasn't enough for you, that's fine. I'm on my own little journey and I feel like I'm on the right path. It might not look like it to the outside, but right now I'm really comfortable with where I'm at and I know where I'm going. So I brushed myself off. I got in the car every day. I listed property and I went on to refinance myself back to where I needed to be to go round two. A year ago, March 2020.
The date.
A year and 3 months ago. I got on a plane and I went back to Europe to go round two to try and do my transfer in world football. And I landed in a place called Congleton, which is where my friend's family live, who I always go and stay with when I first get to the country and just let the jet lag brush off, catch up with them. So I landed, I went upstairs, went to bed, woke up, came down. They put on the news. Boris Johnson came on the TV. The world's got a virus. No one can leave the house for 4 weeks.
Oh, my God.
The week I got there. Oh, and I just went, I'm not meant to do this fucking transfer, man.
Yeah. Like,
the universe.
How many barriers? Yeah.
Telling me something here. Like, this is not meant to be. So I was like, okay, it's 4 weeks. I'm just going to pretend that for the next 4 weeks, I'm in my own place. And I'll just do what I would have been doing anyway, which is ringing people and just going for my walks. So to put it into perspective, you were allowed out for an hour a day for 1 hour to do some exercise. And the rest of the time you had to be in the house. So for the first 4 weeks, I was just doing as much as I could on the phone, staying fit. And then Boris Johnson goes, we're extending it to 12 weeks. Oh, and I went, I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
So I just basically took an application on an apartment down in Liverpool, sight unseen, got a lift with Les, who I was staying with. He kindly dropped me down and I just moved into an apartment in the middle of Liverpool, in the middle of a world virus.
Holy.
And it was honestly like just zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
And it really started to affect a lot of people in that country because the economy in the UK is not good to begin with. Something like this comes along, it's just completely wipes out a lot of people. It was cold. It was coming into winter. Coming out of winter, so it was still cold. And it was just a really, really tough place to be. But I was like, do you know what? In chaos, there's opportunity. Everyone's going to be sat down stressed. Everyone's not going to be doing things. There's going to be a problem out there that I can fix. And that's when I was like, okay, I need to look for someone, as in a player, who's in a situation that needs to be fixed. So that led me to a young player called Bobby Duncan, who's actually the cousin of Steven Gerrard. So it was quite a high-profile player. And he was at a club in Italy called Fiorentina, and he needed to get back into the UK. So I flew to Italy. I flew to Spain, met the family, stayed there for 3 weeks and just built a relationship. They give me the go-ahead to try and sanction the deal. I hired two translators, flew to Italy. When I met with the Fiorentina club with the two Italian translators, put two deal structures forward that I felt needed to be looked at that were best interest of everybody. They agreed. I got back on the phone, rang every single club in England repetitively, put those deal structures forward and managed to broker a deal for the lad from Fiorentina to Derby. And in September, I stood in the stadium at Derby County with the shirt, with Bobby, and I did a deal.
That's that photo that you sent me, hey.
Yeah,
I'll attach that to the show notes so everybody else can see that. It's a sick photo.
Yeah, it was a really cool moment for me because that was something I'd always dreamt of doing. And, you know, it was in a really tough situation in which I've managed to do it. So, you know, it was a catch-22 because I also discovered something else 10 seconds after I'd done it as well. And this was like, okay, this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Wow.
I just knew straight away.
Yeah.
Which was a hard one because I was adamant that football was going to be like my thing forever. So then that came into play a bit where I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? I've done a deal. I've done everything I'd sort of visualized doing in that space. And it's not what I want to do for the rest of my life. COVID, I think for a lot of people, forced us to look for meaning in things. Because when you spend a lot of time on your own in a room all day and society's basically cut off, which in Europe was very much the case, you're left with your own thoughts. You really sort of learn what's important, what's valuable, what things mean to you. So a couple of things were coming into play. I was sort of like, okay, Australia for me is not a bad place to build life. You know, I've been to Florence, I've been to Portugal, I've been to Germany, I've been to Japan, I've been to Spain, I've been around the world. I've been to London, I've been to Dubai. You know, I've seen the world. Is there anywhere I want to build a life other than Oz? I don't think there is. And I think I had to go and see the world to really learn that.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that was the realization was I love real estate. Like real estate for me, I don't think you get to choose your passion. I think it chooses you. And I think that's the mistake I made. I think I force fed football down my throat as this is what you want to do. This is what you love. When in reality, property found me about 3 years before and was basically saying like, mate, this is what we need to be doing. But I don't think I was ready to handle what comes with it yet.
Yeah, and that's really crazy because you always thought that, you know, football was your passion and your goal. But if you were to just sit back and stay in real estate your whole life, you would always put the other side and be like, oh, the grass is greener over there, you know, and have that regret of not actually being uncomfortable and stepping out of your comfort zone. Just like you said, you wouldn't have known if you didn't do it.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic that I may have spent my whole life thinking that I'd missed out on a dream that in reality wasn't actually what my dream was anyway, but I would have lived with the thought process of thinking it was.
That's crazy.